couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, Instant Family, Widows, Outlaw King, and Boy Erased. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring the Pixar Short Film Collection, Volume 3. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The big piece of news that sort of rocked the entertainment industry this week has been the death of Stan Lee, who is the innovative Marvel editor and writer and creator who gave us all the characters like Spider-Man and Incredible Hulk and Fantastic Four and the entire group of Marvel superheroes. And he built that up in the 60s. And of course, he went on to become sort of this media legend. He passed away this week at age 95, which is a great run. I mean, it's not like he disappeared from public life for the last 10 years. He made appearances all the time, and he got interviewed, and of course, he's best known for doing all these cameos in the Marvel movies, and that's how he kind of really raised his appearance and stature among just the average person, because even though there's a lot of people out there who've never put their hands on a Marvel comic book, everybody will recognize him from his cameos and everything from X-Men to Spider-Man. And he's in almost every single Marvel movie that's ever come out, and that's been kind of a fun thing. Whether it was done by Marvel Studios, which is owned by Disney now, or whether it was done by Fox, or whether it was done by Sony, he showed up at him. I think one of his first cameos was actually in The Trial of the Incredible Hulk, where he played a juror, and that was, I think, early 90s. So he was still kind of an obscure person at that point, but he's become a legend, and everybody knows who Stan Lee is, and that's actually kind of amazing considering how much he's done over the course of his life. He started at Marvel, and he brought Marvel from a relatively small comic company and built it into this powerhouse. People knew who Spider-Man was like in the 70s and the 80s. Of course, you had the Incredible Hulk TV show that raised that stature, and Spider-Man was in everything from Electric Company to Halloween costumes, and then had his own TV movies made of him, so people were aware of who the characters were, but he was still just the guy who edited the comics. Now, people who read the comics knew who he was. I grew up in a time where comics were relatively inexpensive. I mean, they were like 25 cents, 40 cents, 50 cents when I was a kid growing up, and I mean, now a single issue is going to be several bucks, but I remember the time, even when I was in high school, where you could get a standard issue for less than a dollar. But even then, there were so many titles out there, I personally could only afford to choose a universe. I chose DC because I was a Superman and Batman guy. And I had a lot of respect for Marvel, but I just never read it. Because if you're going to read one Marvel comic, you had to read all of them or a good chunk of them. And that's the way it was with Superman. I read everything with Superman and Batman in DC, and then I'd read like Green Lantern and then Flash, and then you start picking up other titles, and before you know it, you're reading twice as many comics, and that's expensive. I couldn't afford that as a kid, so I stuck to DC, but even then I knew who Stan Lee was. Even then, I knew about Stan's Soapbox, which was his monthly column at the end of the comics, which was inspirational, and he talked directly to the readers. And I know he did so much work. He didn't single-handedly run the comics, but he spearheaded it. And it was a very collaborative effort, and I know that there were some grumblings over the years as to who created what, but as he got into his later years, it was very clear saying, look, this was a collaborative effort. He would sketch out ideas in terms of what's going to happen on the page, and then the artist would take over. And so his hand and his feeling and his touch was seen in so many of different books, and that allowed him to spearhead multiple titles at once. So that was a lot of the work that he did in his 40s back, 50 years ago. And now he has become a legend. And even though he really hasn't worked in the Marvel comics for years, and there were lawsuits, and he's kind of done his own thing, he still has that legacy of being the guy behind these. And Marvel has always been forever tied to Stan Lee. And that's a legacy that he leaves. And this is the real point of what he did and the impact he had in creating these characters. He didn't just make super characters in fantasy. He made characters that had real problems. I mean, like the Fantastic Four, which is one of the first things he created. It was a family living together. It's people living with each other and dealing with each other's problems and learning how to, you know, Johnny Storm and the Thing, Ben, constantly fought. And that's kind of part of his deal. They also didn't have secret identities, which is kind of odd for some characters. I mean, he kind of had his own way of doing the comics. It wasn't just Batman or Superman putting on glasses or pretending to be a billionaire playboy. He had real people who were oftentimes overcoming problems that they had, but their problems were also part of their power. Daredevil was blind, but that leaned into his power. Tony Stark had a weak heart, but that allowed him to build the Iron Man costume and character. Real problems, real people in a fantastic setting. And Stan Lee was somebody who lived his catchphrase of Excelsior, which is ever upward, always achieving, and that's something he always did up until the day he died. So we will miss you, Stan Lee. Excelsior. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. One of the award films that I'm kind of looking forward to that's kind of bubbling under the surface, it's coming out at the end of December for limited release, is Stan and Ollie. And it's about Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy and their relationship.
Pretty empty last night.
I guess people just don't want to see Laurel and Hardy anymore.
Has he been pushing you a little too hard, babe?
You know, Stan.
You could have said goodbye, Oliver, a long time ago.
We had a good thing going, but you had this big chip on your shoulder because I did a picture with someone else.
I couldn't sleep for days when they told me what you did. You got lucky because you met me.
Lucky to spend my life with a man who hides behind his typewriter.
I have always been a huge fan of Laurel and Hardy. Maybe as much as the Three Stooges, if not more. I love the Three Stooges, but there was something special about Laurel and Hardy that really captured my imagination. I remember as a kid going up and visiting my grandparents over Christmas and Thanksgiving, and they lived in Cleveland, and so we'd watch, you know, the Cleveland shows and the morning shows like Superhost or whatever. They'd always play a Laurel and Hardy short or something like that. That was always something that I grew up watching, even in the 70s, even though those stories were like 40 years old sometimes. And I have a real affinity towards them. I remember we just recently, my family, we had to move a piano out of my mom's house to our place. And after we finally got it into our place, I downloaded and showed my kids The Music Box, the famous episode of them moving the piano. And it was hilarious because we were doing, essentially, we weren't as ridiculous as Laurel and Hardy, but it really was a funny thing to watch. Move a piano and then watch The Music Box, let me tell you. So I'm looking forward to Stan and Ollie. I'm really curious to see what they do. And in terms of delving into the characters that people don't know in the behind the scenes. The next one I want to talk about really quickly is Detective Pikachu, which opens on May 10th.
Did you just talk?
Whoa. Did you just understand me?
Oh my God, you can understand me!
Stop!
I've been so lonely!
They try to talk to me all the time. All they hear is Pika Pika.
You can hear him, right?
Pika Pika!
Yeah, Pika Pika Pika. He's adorable.
You're adorable. They can't understand me, kid.
Can no one else hear him?
I don't need a Pokemon, period.
Then what about a world-class detective? Because if you want to find your pops, I'm your best bet.
Here's a great example of a movie that lives completely on nostalgia, and it is the nostalgia for the people who poo-poo the nostalgia. There's all these people who are in their like late 20s and early 30s who are like, oh, this Star Wars is just about nostalgia. You guys are stupid. Oh my God, Pikachu, that's my childhood. And that's basically what you're seeing happen. Nostalgia is okay, people. It's okay to live on a nostalgia, and Detective Pikachu looks like it's definitely going into there. It actually looks kind of funny. It looks like it's, I'm kind of looking forward to like a photorealistic CGI Pokemon movie that isn't just a throwaway cartoon. Ryan Reynolds as Pikachu? I still am not quite sold, but we'll see. Come May 10th. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Instant Family and Widows.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out!
and welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and start off with Instant Family. A middle-aged couple decide to become foster parents to three troubled siblings.
Lizzie comes with two younger siblings.
Three kids? Too much.
No.
Oh my God.
They're adorable.
Why would you show us that? That's wrong.
Here we are.
Make yourself at home, because you're at home.
But I don't want this! Ow!
Just stay there until the fire department comes, okay?
You're just another white lady who wants to adopt charity orphans to make you feel good about yourself. Pretend mom!
This stuff takes time. Lizzie had to parent Juan and Lita all by herself.
This is never going to be easy.
But with some structure and love, you could make your house a home.
This film is directed by Sean Anders, who is most recently best known for doing films like Daddy's Home and Daddy's Home 2. Daddy's Home 2 came out last Christmas, and two Christmases before that in 2015, you had Daddy's Home. Now, those were both surprise hits. And what's funny about those movies is they both of them flew in under the Star Wars release. They both came in right around the same time. And they lost a lot of their thunder to Star Wars, but they were actually really big hits. And much to the consternation of some grumpy critics who don't like comedies, they did very, very well. And of course, made a sequel. And Sean Anders is essentially a guy who does screwball comedies. He did the movie, I think he did Horrible Bosses too. I find his stuff pretty funny. You know, he's not awful, but he's also not he's not the best comedic director I've ever seen. Now, it's interesting with Instant Family, when you watch the trailer or you look at the pitch, you're like, oh, this is just another stupid screwball family comedy. And in a way it is. Let's not mince words. There's parts of it in like the first 20 minutes of the movie does have me rolling my eyes a couple times because it is really laying it on thick. And look, Rose Byrne's hilarious, and she's, I think, underutilized by Hollywood in a lot of ways, but she is just sort of playing that stock character that we've seen as them. Oh, I want to be a mom, but I also want to have my freedom. You know, everything that anybody who's considering having kids or adopting is going through. And this could have completely devolved into a very typical antic after antic where it's meant to be bigger than life or overly silly and overly contrived scenes. You got overly contrived scenes in both Daddy's Homes movies. But here's the difference with Instant Family. Sean Anders, the director and writer of this, himself adopted three foster kids. He brought them in, and he and his wife decided to get the teenager, the older kids, not the, from what I understand, I'm not a foster parent, but as I understand it, I would imagine that it's much more different adopting like a baby or a toddler and adopting a teenager who's had most of their life, had some, you know, ups and downs and ins and outs. And that's certainly seems like a challenge. Now I have my own kids and I'm pushing into my late 40s. So the chance of me adopting or even wanting any more kids at this point is pretty slim, but I can appreciate if you don't have kids and you're having trouble conceiving, I can appreciate the interest in going into this. What makes this movie different is because Anders has gone through the foster parent system, he gives at least what it appears to be a relatively realistic and optimistic, but not overly optimistic view of what goes on. There's a lot of realism here, and there's a lot of heart to it. And it seems to me like Anders doesn't want to just make it goofy and silly. He also wants to show a reality of the foster care system where it's an overburdened system. And the kids in there, through no fault of their own, are sometimes in really awful situations. And they're probably coming from really awful situations. And so some of the kids, especially the teenagers, either that have become foster kids when they're teenagers or have lived in the system for many, many years and are just waiting to age out, it's a tough battle, and they're oftentimes coming with a lot of baggage. And there's a lot of love that can be had there, but it takes, and they say it in the movie, it takes a special person to do it. What I found fascinating about this is, I've been racking my brains trying to find a movie that gives this balanced of a look at the foster care system. Because usually it's like in a sitcom, it's used as a backstory. I was a foster kid, and that's why I don't trust you. Or the kid at school is struggling, and he's got a bully who's in the foster care system. I remember in the 80s, there was this kid, and he was an actor, and he was like, I don't know, 10 or 11, and he got curly black hair, and he showed up in every single sitcom as a foster kid. And then you had TV shows like Different Strokes, and they would do stuff where they dealt with adoption and blended families and foster care. But Different Strokes was a little bit saccharine, and it didn't really show the reality of it. Or you had Punky Brewster, but that one was also, he lived in this fantasy world. It's not really looked at as a realistic, pragmatic system where the people are really trying to help, but they just have so many kids that they can't place, and there's only so many parents. And this movie actually does that. Its heart's completely in the right place, even if the jokes don't always land, and even if the jokes are a little bit goofy at times. This movie certainly is trying and succeeding in doing some stuff that I've never seen done before, and its heart's what made me like it. That won me over. It won me over out of just being some goofy, wacky sitcom-type movie. So I'm going to have to say Instant Family surprised me, and I'm going to say it's worth seeing, especially if you have any sort of interest or care or connections to the foster system. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on and talk about widows. After a shootout kills their criminal husbands, a group of widows band together to pull off the heist that had already been planned.
Something happened tonight, something bad. Mr. Mulligan, your family's been involved in Harry's life for many years. I need help.
I don't see what I can do.
Our husbands aren't coming back. We're on our own. My husband left me the plans for his next job. All I need is a crew to pull it off.
Why should we trust you anyway?
Because I'm the only one standing between you and a bullet in your head.
This is directed by Steve McQueen, who of course did 12 Years a Slave and Shame. And I was kind of looking forward to this movie. They didn't show it to me, and that happens a lot. And I talked about this. I railed about it a couple weeks ago. I don't know if this movie's falling in the realm of, like, Hunter Killer, which was another famously not screened movie. And I know they've screened Widows just to other audiences. But for whatever reason, this wasn't important. I think it's because it's coming under the shadow of The Crimes of Grindelwald. And I think this is a movie they're hoping for a slower burn through award season, not a big opening weekend. The irony of this is I'm getting mailers from the studio saying, for your consideration, this movie. And I'm like, that's great. You want to show it to me? And I'm certain that next week or sometime shortly after Thanksgiving, I'm going to get a screener for this. And Fox is going to send me a disc. They're not having an actual screening, but they're actually going to probably find a way to show it to me. And like I said, I'll probably be able to watch it without even going to the theater in the next week or so. So I was like, why should I even bother? If they're not going to bother to show this to me early, why should I bother to go bust my butt through snow to go see it in a movie theater when I got other things to do? I'll just wait a week. If all they're worried about is the award consideration, screw you. I'll just hold on to that and I'll watch it in a couple weeks. The same thing happened with that Roman J. Israel Esquire movie last year with Denzel Washington. No screening whatsoever. Didn't go see it. And a week later, I got a screener. So I'll probably review this later. But for right now, Widows gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, and Boy Erased. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. And let's talk about Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald. A young Albus Dumbledore enlists the help of Newt Scamander to stop the criminal Grindelwald before he can lead a faction of pure magic bloods to enslave the Muggles.
I take it you've heard the rumors. Grindelwald had a vision that he would rise to dominance over the wizarding world.
So you're asking me to help hunt him down?
I can't move against Grindelwald. It has to be you. In your shoes, I'd probably refuse to. It's late.
Good evening, Newt.
Oh, come on.
I was a big fan of the Harry Potter movies. I didn't love them all ubiquitously, and I thought the first one was fine, but they certainly got better as they went on. And without it, there was a little hiccup with number 5, which was The Order of the Phoenix. Overall, I really thought that they steamrolled to the end to a good, solid conclusion. And if you take the movie, you know, like The Half-Blood Prince, which is the 6th movie, and compare it to the first movie, there's just really no comparison. The first movie is fine, but Chris Columbus didn't do a very good job directing that. He did a better job doing the second one. But overall, the Harry Potter movies, I think, are great. They're the closest you can get to a different generation that I can relate to for Star Wars. I mean, Star Wars, for me, as a kid, defined my life when I was a child. Even though when I was a child, there were only 3 movies. And Harry Potter, I totally see why people get wrapped up into that. And once the Harry Potter books and movies wrapped up, I totally understand why everyone who was involved with them says, holy cow, there's still a lot more money to make on these. Let's make that. And so the Fantastic Beasts series started in book form. I never read it. I read a couple of the Harry Potter books, but I wasn't voraciously devouring those. By the time I got around to reading them, they were cranking the movies out. So I was like, why bother reading? But I never read the Fantastic Beasts books. I saw Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, which came out, 2 years ago? And I mean, it was a fine movie. There was something lacking in it. And then when I watched The Crimes of Grindelwald, I kind of felt the same way. I mean, it has all the elements you'd expect from a movie that takes place in that Harry Potter universe. You've got the wizards, you've got the wands, you've got the magic, you've got the creatures, you've got the action sequences. You got things blowing up and over-the-top things happening. You've got overly dark and creepy, weird characters. You have the inexplicable reason why everybody's keeping themselves secret. I don't know why. I never quite understood that. You're the most powerful creatures in the world, so you're going to keep yourself secret. That's how we work in this world. So in a certain way, the things that Grindelwald and Voldemort eventually are doing, they're basically saying, hey, let's live at large and in the forefront because we're the most powerful creatures on the planet. The heck with these human beings that are causing all these problems. So there's a certain part of me that I understand their philosophy, not their genocidal philosophy, but at the very least, I never quite understand. I mean, I get it for story purposes why all this has to be kept secret from the real world, but it still doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Anyways, I liked it in the other movie. They got to go to America. They got to see what the wizarding world was like in other countries, which they have a little bit of that in the Harry Potter books, but it's very British-centric. And this one, they go to Paris, and so you see it, the Wizarding World International. It's a beautiful-looking movie, and David Yates, the director, certainly has gotten used to directing in this world. He's directed, like, the last 5 Harry Potter movies or something like that. There's really something lacking. I mean, there's something about grounding it with Harry Potter and the kids going through a year of school, because the Harry Potter movies are Harry's story, and it's Harry's journey through that year. And there's a beginning, middle, and end, and an arc that you follow with Harry Potter. And there's all this stuff in the background going on with Voldemort coming back, and there's that overreaching arcs that are happening in the background that you can follow, but the story's still about Harry and what he's experiencing that year. And that's why those movies work. And that's exactly why this movie doesn't. There is no arc through the movie. Things happen. You get to the thing and you're like, there's a beginning, there's a middle, there's an end. There's all the elements you'd expect. You know, there's a climax and a battle and all this. You get to the end and you're like, ah, that felt like a complete movie, but something was missing. And that's because there's no real beginning, middle, and end to a story. It's just, we're just a section of a story. It feels almost serialized at this point. The grounding on Harry Potter, that's missing in this movie. And that's what makes us feel just like a puzzle piece at this point. And that's also why when they finally show up at Hogwarts, it's kind of exciting because you're like, oh, Hogwarts, that's kind of where all the cool stuff happened. That's where the character moments happened. And that's just because they got to go see Dumbledore and everything. But you do get that ooh, gosh, and gasp of the audience when they first show Hogwarts. But still, I don't know. There's something missing. There's something not there. Some magic isn't quite in the magic movie. But still, I mean, for entertainment purposes, and if you're a huge fan of the Wizarding World, you're going to love this movie because it has everything you want, cloaks and wizards and spells. So I'll say generously that Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Boy Erased. The son of a devout pastor undergoes conversion therapy when it is revealed to his family that he is gay.
I love you, but we cannot see a way that you can live under this roof if you're going to fundamentally go against the grain of our beliefs. Jared, tell me the truth. That's all.
I think about men.
Your parents signed you up for a program to fix you, but Jared, you are a perfectly normal, very healthy teenage boy.
They're gonna do things for you.
This movie's directed by Joel Edgerton, who plays the guy doing the conversion therapy in the movie. And it's important to point out that Edgerton directed this because even though he's not directed a whole lot of stuff, he certainly has a style, and his style is very muted and drawn back. What you'd expect from a movie like this is the obvious indictment of that conversion therapy system, which is nonsense. It's hogwash. We should be able to agree on that. Psychologists and people have weighed in around, but there are still people who believe in conversion therapy. And you make the jokes you want of saying, well, it's ridiculous. Let's take kids that think they're gay and put them all together in a room and try to convince them that they're not gay, which I think is kind of madness when you think about it. It's like doing a Weight Watchers meeting at a all-you-can-eat buffet. I mean, there's a lot of psychological issues that can be resulting from this, and it's at times very villainous and dangerous. I mean, psychologically dangerous to people. This is illegal in some states and should be illegal everywhere. And what you expect from a movie like this is the grand indictment of conversion therapy. You really don't get that. It's very muted. It shows that it's at times total nonsense. And it shows some of the dangerous practices and some of the unexpected results that you could totally expect happen. You know, there's tragic things that result, but it's all kind of muted down. And you don't get the confrontation. There's like one scene where you kind of get confrontation, but not really. And there's also little things that did bother me about it. Like I'll give you a great example. And I think this is all from because it's a real life story. It's just things that happened to this person in real life. So they didn't want to take too many liberties with it. But there is one moment in there it reinforces a untrue and negative stereotype about homosexuals in that they're all child molesters and that they're rapists and potential rapists. And there's a scene in there that hints to that, not hints to it being for everybody, but it's a scene that can be interpreted that way. And that bothers me because that's just simply not true. That has been repeated enough in certain people in the media to make people think it's true, but it's not. There's no greater instance of this. And you talk to homosexuals and they feel really strongly about this because they're demonized in a lot of ways when they shouldn't be. And this is one of the ways they are. And there's a side plot of this that kind of hints at that. And I, if it really happened, that's fine. But it's an isolated event. It's not meant to be ubiquitous of everything. And I think that's part of the thing is this is this one guy's experience as opposed to really giving a holistic look at the problem of conversion therapy and some of the other things that go along in this movie. And so I think it's an important film to see, but I didn't think it was as good as it could have been. So I'm going to have to say Boy Erased did still kind of rock.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to have a look back at the TV show The Office, review Outlaw King, do the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring the Pixar Short Film Collection, Volume 3. To Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews. I'm going to actually review something that I don't normally do. I don't do a whole lot of TV, mainly because I don't have time to watch all the TV that is out there. I mean, that's like a full-time job. Not only in TV do you got to watch broadcast now, but you got to watch basic cable, you got to watch premium cable, and now you got to watch Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and HBO Direct Series and, you know, like CBS All Access so you can get Star Trek. There's so many things that you got to watch. It's like five times as much TV as you used to have to watch 10, 15, 20 years ago. So yeah, I don't do a whole lot of TV, but I'm going to cover this one piece here. I revisited the show The Office recently. My son and I watch TV shows together. And I said, oh, this will be fun. And it's 9 seasons. It'll take us, you know, a couple months to watch it. And so I actually have some interesting thoughts about it. And now that it's been 5 years since the show ended, the shenanigans of a paper company in Scranton, Pennsylvania is examined in this mockumentary.
What the?
What the?
I still love it after 7 years.
What the?
Oh, this is so important. I should run to answer it.
Shut the fuck up.
So that's the way it's done.
Do it! Surprise! It's a joke! You're joking around! Put my stuff in Jell-O again!
Just a couple things to note. In looking at it 5 years later, the show really stumbled after Michael Scott left, after Steve Carell left to do regular movies. It really did stumble because it didn't know what to do. He was the grounding force of that show. But then the whole 7th season, it was trying to find its footing. The show didn't quite know what to do. Once it got to the 8th season, it kind of figured out what it was doing. And actually, by the 9th season, by its final season, it kind of figured out how to make a show as an ensemble comedy rather than an ensemble comedy wrapped around one person. It really did kind of hit a stride right before it ended. Now, of course, the ratings had dropped and everything, and because losing Steve Carell made an impact. But that's, I think, an interesting thing that happened. I think they botched it, bringing in Robert California, played by James Spader. I didn't think he turned out as well as he could have, but they did bring in Catherine Tate and finally bring her into there, and I thought she was brilliant in it. Now, the other thing I noticed is I realized a couple things about the characters. First of all, Jim and Pam are meant to be the heroes of the show. Jim's kind of like the hero. He's really not the hero. I mean, they portray him as the hero, but he's not. He's a heel. He's manipulative, and he's kind of a jerk to a lot of people. He's a jerk to all the other women that he dates just so he can pine for Pam, which makes a nice little romance in the show, but it's garbage behavior for a human being to have. And with that said, Pam's kind of garbage herself as well. You can learn a lot about a person by who they date. And I said this to my son as we're watching, and I said, don't wait for somebody like that. I know it makes a good TV show. But if there's a woman who's, oh, she's so wonderful for you, but she's dating a jerk, she's going to date jerks. You will find a common history in that person. And waiting for them is you're just going to waste your time. And then when they finally get married, she kind of turns into a, you know, kind of a pain in the butt. Yeah, some of the things she's justified in, but even then, Jim is, it's Jim being an idiot. He makes decisions whether he like starts a company in another state. He buys a house without consulting her. That's not good behavior. Somebody respects their wife. So that's something I found interesting, and just kind of how it plays out and how the tone of the show is a little different when you look back at it as opposed to being in the thick of it. But still, I have to say, I do love The Office. It's a lot of fun. Doesn't hit its stride until about the 3rd season, but it still rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about The Outlaw King, which is on Netflix. It dropped on Netflix last week. I figured I'd take a look at it because it's kind of got a little buzz when it first had dropped a trailer, and it's gotten a little bit of buzz afterwards because it's got Chris Pine in it. That's a kind of a big name to be putting as a you've got headlining actors on Netflix now. An outlaw king, nobleman Robert the Bruce, defies the British crown when he tries to secure control of Scotland.
We need to unite Scotland. Robert the Bruce is an outlaw. Any man or woman who would give shelter to him or his ranks is to be executed without trial.
The people are desperate for justice.
I serve Robert Bruce! Join us to free Ireland!
This is an interesting companion piece to watch with Braveheart because it sort of begins where Braveheart ends. Where Braveheart ends with the death of William Wallace after he had led the Scottish Rebellion and sort of paved the way for Robert the Bruce to reclaim his right to the throne of Scotland. this movie tells Robert the Bruce's story. And obviously it's played by different actors and they're 20 years apart in terms of when they were made. And also Braveheart's a far superior movie. Let me just put that out there. But there's some interesting stuff in Outlaw King. You've got Chris Pine playing the Scottish King. And he does okay. I still don't quite buy him in the role. He still is too pretty. And it does tend to, when a lot of these movies, these historical films, when they're dealing with the power struggles, unless you really know the players involved, like I watched it with my father. And my father's a huge fan of like European history. And so he knows who Robert the Bruce was and he knew who all these different characters were and he knew how they all fit together in the grand scheme of things. But it's at times a little hard to follow if you don't know all that stuff because it's just a bunch of dirty people fighting each other. And they also have Robert the Bruce's wife, or who's essentially a wife slave who's brought in and they overplay her character a bit. You get this a lot in historic movies. The sad fact is that in a movie, you know, in Scotland at this time, the women were not in charge. It's just, that's a fact of history. Is it the right thing that should have happened? No, but that's the way history works. And so they try to make her a little more influential when she probably really wasn't, but they needed to have the strong female character. But overall, the movie, it's fine to sort of to watch it. It runs a little bit long and it gets a little bit muddled in the middle and it does overplay the brutality. I mean, it's real brutal in, you know, battles back then, but you know, even just in the back home and how they used the townspeople as fodder for their grievances against noblemen. Overall, I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks. It because it just doesn't quite, It doesn't make itself very easy to follow.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Really quickly about the box office. Last weekend, The Grinch did extremely well, actually overperformed. And that bodes well for this. It's gonna ride well into Christmas. There's going to be a lot of family movies that's going to compete with it. So it got to jump in it and made almost $70 million last week. And then, of course, Bohemian Rhapsody came in second. But then Overlord only made about 10, and then, you know, The Girl in the Spider's Web really kind of flopped with less than 8 million in its opening weekend. So this weekend, of course, Crimes of Grindelwald is going to win. We all know that. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Spotlight this week is on the Pixar Short Film Collection, Volume 3. The third volume of short films comes from Pixar, featuring new, diverse stories with groundbreaking animation.
This is going to be the best night of our lives!
My favorite thing is that we got to tell a very different story, a very personal story, and a story that's based in a very personal culture. I'm really proud of that.
They wanted to tell a story that was inspired by growing up as a little bun.
Something I was really passionate about, that we need to see these characters that we love get what they want.
Look, if you've seen all the Pixar movies in the theaters, you've seen all these short films. These are what they always run in front of their other movies. And they've got everything from Partysaurus Rex to Bao. And it's a great selection of short films. They're beautiful short films. And unless you've bought all the Pixar films, you don't have these. So it's a nice way to get them in one collection. And it's interesting to also go back to like Tin Toy, if you've collected these, to go back to the first Pixar short film, like Tin Toy, and watch it in comparison to these and how the animation has changed. I mean, if you go back and look at the animation in Piper, it's just gorgeous, or Lava is beautiful. So these are some amazing things that are done. And you see familiar faces with the Toy Story characters, and you see the characters from Inside Out, and you see the cars coming back, and there's little mini movies. So you basically have, you know, little extra short films. And you also have a couple Blu-ray features, like commentaries from the filmmakers and a look back at how they made Bao, and just a couple more behind the scenes things. But the real reason to get this is for the short films that just keep getting better and better and better. And are fascinating to compare to the earlier Pixar films, where the photorealism in these are just amazing. And it's worth seeing. Totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Other movies that are coming out on DVD and Blu-ray include The Meg, Mile 22, Star Trek Discovery Season 1, Alpha, and Juliet Naked. And that is it for this week. When I come back next week, we'll be fat with turkey and happy Thanksgiving. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.